This is tape two, side B. You were in the middle of explaining this horrible accident, unfortunately. But the key thing I think you wanted to stress, I don't want to cut you off, but that this set you back in your research quite a
little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
I was going to the library every day, but that was a little bit of a distraction. But other than that, I mean, then we got back to the lab quickly, and we my girlfriend went back to the lab after maybe 10 days. So we're back to normal. And she was also doing new things for her. So for both of us, first year was struggle,
right,
scientifically. But we didn't really have problem having fun. It was exciting to live in different country, so.
Yeah. Talk about, I asked you about the lab management style of your mentor earlier. How about Carl Wu? How did he run his lab?
Carl was quite a bit different. At the time, he already had 5 or 6 postdocs. And he was not doing experiments anymore because NIH is very bureaucratic. He needed to do a lot of things, and he needed writing and everything. But again, he would come in late and used to stay until 8, 9, something like that. And I actually don't know what he was doing every day. He was in office very often, but also he wandered around a lot. And he would look over our shoulders and see, oh, what's going on? What's that band? What's that gel?
Mm-hmm.
So we started hiding our data until I, you know, digest our data before talking to Carl. But he was pretty close to the lab in a sense. Later, and we were jam-packed in the laboratory. And then that was the time that lab was most productive, I think.
Right.
Then later he was promoted, and the lab was divided into 2 levels. And then people who were on the same floor with Carr were okay, but people who were left behind, I think, felt like they were left alone a little bit.
Right.
So that made it a little harder for people. That's how I learned, you know, you should be close to the lab all the time. That's why I wanted to move to this space that's close to the lab, even though I'm not using this office much at all.
Mm-hmm.
And though he would usually, so he's a big picture person, so he would give us general direction of the experiments, what we should, you know, that this is the direction I'm excited. But for everyday experiment, he was not on the top of it. He didn't know detail of the experiments we do because he had been away from bench wall for a while. So we needed to figure out everyday thing. Troubleshooting, basically, was up to us. So that might have been hard for some people who are not good at troubleshooting.
How was it for you?
I actually like troubleshooting a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was the only person doing that kind of experiment in the lab or anywhere else, basically. And Carl had no idea how the experiments are done, so I didn't even expect him to say anything about the detail. So I basically did troubleshooting all by myself.
Mm.
And it was good, actually, good experience. And one of the typical things, so, for example, when I decided to purify this factor nerve, I never had real experience with chromatography or proton purification. So I asked him, because he's a good biochemist, what should I do? And his answer was, you just have to try. That's a typical Carl's answer, which is true. But, you know, you have to try because every protein is so different. There's no simple rule.
Right.
But, yeah. But the answer is very, very typical of Carl. So he's supportive and everything, but he doesn't give you detail.
Right. He wants you to figure out the details.
Right. Right. I think he's a person, he's good at doing those things himself, so he cannot think that some people can't figure things out by themselves.
Right.
So people who struggle, there are people who quit science after me, several of them. So part of that is you got to be lucky, but part of that is you have to have the right personality to be in Carl's lab, I think.
Mm-hmm. How about the general mood of the lab? I mean,
it changed a bit in the first half when everybody was in the same room, and at the time that everybody was having pretty productive time, so it was great. I didn't have really any, I didn't see any problems. People got along reasonably well, and we were all excited about our work, and it was really good. In the second half, after the lab split, and some people moved on, and a few people who came in got a little unhappy about how their projects were going, or some people didn't get along with Carl, which is very rare, but that happened. So after I left, three people quit science, I think, within a year or so, maybe mm-hmm. four. So last 1 or 2 years in Carl's lab, I could feel like the atmosphere was not as good as the first half.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I cared much. Because you know, being a postdoc, you really it's really easy to be selfish. It's all about your experiment. You have every control over your project. And, you know, it's nice to have colleagues who are doing well and happy, but at the same time, if someone is not doing well or not very happy, it's not your problem, okay. in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So I could shut off myself and I just concentrate on my work. And as I said, it's nothing compared to my graduate lab, I mean, my Hiroshima lab. So it was nothing to me. Some people complain about atmosphere, but I told them my experience in Hiroshima and laughed about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was having a very good relationship with Carl. I don't think I ever had any problem, and I still maintain that with him.
Right.
And to me, he was and he has been a great mentor.
Mm-hmm. Did you continue the routine that you had adopted in grad school? Did you come in around maybe 10 or 12?
Yeah, I wanted to do it. The problem is, at the beginning, we lived a little bit far from NIH, and parking at NIH is really bad. That's one thing. Finding parking lot after 9 is a nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
And number two, we couldn't afford more than one car at the time. And also, my girlfriend likes to go to the lab early. She goes to bed really early. So basically, I had no choice but to get up early, earlier than usual, and go home a little earlier. So I think I used to go to the lab at 8:30 to 9 and stayed there until 7 or something like that, 7, 8. Then I would have dinner. And she doesn't like to work after having dinner because she gets sleepy. So it was rare to go back to work after dinner.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let us get you to, correct me if I'm wrong, you have two cell papers and you have a Nature paper that comes out of research that you do in this lab.
Right.
Right. Talk about the chromatin remodeling mm-hmm. research that you did.
Okay. So that finding came out of nowhere. Actually, it was a surprise. So, as I said, originally the aim of the project was to reconstitute open chromatin structure in test tube, and from genetics we knew. A DNA binding protein called GAGA factor, because it binds GAGA sequence, is required for establishment of this open chromatin structure. John List at Cornell had shown that they transfected a piece of DNA into flies with and without binding site for this GAGA factor, and showed that only when GAGA factor binding sites are present, you can get open chromatin structure. So that was the biggest aspect for a factor that's necessary for opening up chromatin. Whether that's actually directly doing the job was not known at the time. So what I decided to do was to take plasmid template containing the promoter of our interest and purified this GAGA factor that's expressed in E. coli recombinantly and added to the template, and then assembled chromatin with and without this factor, basically, to see how chromatin structure changes. Because if GAGA factor binding induces open chromatin structure in test tube, that's a direct proof that this factor is responsible for this reaction. So I did that after long struggle. So to get this assembly system working and this GAGA factor, it took me a year, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, I got result that says addition of GAGA factor indeed establishes open chromatin structure, which is very exciting because nobody had done that before. But I don't remember who proposed this. I think it's Carr's idea. So as a biochemist, if you see something really interesting, next thing you do is to purify the system to basically disassemble the system and identify minimum components that's required to observe what you saw
right
at the beginning. So that's what I started to do, thinking that one thing I didn't tell you is to assemble chromatin in test tube, we were using crude extract from Drosophila embryos. So that has millions of different proteins. So, and we already knew, So then we thought, we were not sure that GAGA factor alone could open up chromatin because we already knew that it's energetically very expensive to change position of the nucleus cells or change structure of chromatin. So we suspected there's some cofactor in chromatin assembly extract that's helping GAGA factor to do the job. So that's why we decided to fractionate the chromatin extract, assembly extract. First thing I tried to do was basically purify chromatin, assembled chromatin out of the chromatin assembly mixture because it has a ton of other proteins. So then after that, I added GAGA factor, nothing happens. Okay, so this is good because then I can tell then that the GAGA factor alone is not sufficient, even though it's required for opening up chromatin structure. That means there's something that's missing after purification of chromatin. Then I immediately thought, if I find what it is, it's a big deal. Now, originally, I thought that, and Carl thought, it's something in chromatin assembly mixture because it has a ton of different proteins. Then I added protein back, nothing happened. I thought, well, this is strange. Then I realized that for chromatin assembly reaction, I added ATP because chromatin assembly process is ATP dependent. But I didn't add back ATP because there's no reason to believe that this process was ATP dependent. So then instead of DNA, assembly extract, I added back ATP alone. Then here we go, we get chromatin transition.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the very first discovery, actually, of ATP-dependent chromatin remodeling. So to date, I think this is the biggest contribution I made in science, the discovery of one new biological phenomenon that if I can get something bigger than that before I retire, I'll be happy. But so that was how it was discovered, and I'm pretty sure Carl doesn't remember this now, but he didn't believe my result at the beginning. I showed his data and he said, which is not his fault because this was not described anywhere before, quality of data was not that great. So, but I didn't care at the time because I was very confident about my result. And I had to change protocol to purify chromatin to get cleaner results. But at the end, we got the result, and that was the Nature paper.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was easy next time. Then after that, I decided to go after this. Later, I also showed that it's not just ATP. There's a factor that requires utilizes ATP to do chromatin remodeling. So I decided to purify this factor X in chromatin assembly extract that helps GAGA factor to change chromatin structure. That's basically those cell papers.
Right, the cell papers.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but looking at your CV, you're in his lab from 1992 then to 97.
That's right.
In the last 2 years, you're there as visiting associate.
Right.
And is that basically a title that allows you to carry on your research or?
Yes. So this was, I actually don't know why I was promoted. Oh, I know that. So I could have stayed as visiting assistant. What was the first title?
The first title was
assistant. No.
Visiting fellow.
Visiting fellow, and then that's right. So I think we needed to do that to get my visa status changed.
Oh, okay.
So I came with a J-1 visa, which is an exchange visa, and. People who come to the U.S. with J-1 visa has obligation to go back to their home countries for stay there for 2 years before revisiting this country for extended period of time. And Carr wanted me to stay there for longer than a J-1 visa would usually allow. So we started the process. Then for doing that, he needed to promote me. Because the NIH rule didn't allow visiting fellow to be to get visa changed. And this is kind of interesting story. I think Carr wanted me to stay there as a scientist also. He actually offered me a job when I was on job market, which is not very typical in this country. But he was just promoted and he had a few slots to fill, and one of the So, it's a little bit delicate. He indicated that if I apply to a job in his department, there's a good chance that I would be, he said I would be considered seriously.
Right.
But also he indicated that I have to also look for a job outside because, NIH is only a place I know. In U.S. and also it would not look good for him to hire someone who cannot get the job outside.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'm ahead of the schedule, but when I was looking for job, I was in a sense not that serious about looking for job, half knowing that there's a good chance I would get a job at the NIH.
Right.
It was a little bit more like, oh, let's see how it is like outside. So I think that was his long-term plan. He didn't say at the beginning, but that's how he promoted me to fellow, I think.
Right.
Then I got the H1, which would have allowed me to stay in this country for a longer time.
Right. And how important do you believe were the papers? I mean, there's this, I guess what I'm getting at is that there's a debate that's going on about sort of the over-reliance sometimes or the overestimation of journal articles to promotion and advancing people in their careers. Pro and con on that. I mean, in your own case, in your own experience, how important do you think the cell paper and the two cell papers and the Nature paper were?
In getting a job here?
Yeah, in getting a job here. Or
it was
just being heard, I guess.
Probably very important. Not necessarily because they were publishing those journals, I don't think. But if, say, I published those papers in, I don't know, Genes and Development or something like that, I think I would have gotten the same job.
Right.
of course, if, let's say, I have to evaluate someone, when we do search here, and if I have to evaluate someone outside of my field, it's very hard for me to say how good the research is. So it's understandable in some places people take heavy weight on where papers are published, because people automatically consider, you know, to get paper published in Cell, Nature, and Science, you have to have high standard, which is not necessarily always true. We all know that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a convenient way of measuring things. But it, I think, depends a lot on the department. One thing I was very intrigued after joining the Hutch was the first search we had after I was hired. There was a candidate who had like 8 papers in Cell, Nature, and Science.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even give this guy an interview because we felt that this person was at the right place at the right time, and not, we didn't see creativity. So what this place, especially basic science division, values most is whether or not the person has established new concept or new ways of figuring things out. How creative that person is the most important thing. So there are people who got hired out of 2 papers, basically.
Mm-hmm.
2 papers not in Cell or Nature or Science, but something really new.
Right.
And of course, this place may be exceptional. I know this is like really, really good place to do science. And a lot of people have broad interest. Maybe that's why we can do it. And this is a small division. But so it depends on the place, I think. In some places, I know people count numbers of publications and places or name of the journals. That would be sad, because that's almost like making confession that they cannot evaluate science.
Right.
This place is definitely not like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like it's fortunate that I'm in that environment.
We bring up the question of creativity. And thinking back now to your Cremington remodeling research, mm-hmm. that you did, what were the ingredients that you needed personally to make that discovery, which, you know, you've admitted is probably, if you can do another one like this again, you'll be very happy.
Yeah.
What were the conditions that allowed that?
One thing probably was, you mean personal side or experimental side or...
I guess, you mentioned creativity, so I was thinking, I'm trying to get at the heart of what allows certain discoveries to be made.
Okay.
So it could be all of these things. It could be personal, it could be technical, right. Any of it.
Yeah, scientifically, I was extremely lucky. One is that previous postdoc, Peter Becker, had established this new in vitro chromatin remodeling system that didn't exist before. And not much was done using that system, so a lot of things were basically up for grab. So I was in at the right place at the right timing. That's a big part of it. If I didn't have that system, or if I joined the lab 10 years later, after everybody, a lot of interesting things were done using that system, it would have been hard to do the same thing. That's one thing. The other thing probably might be what my girlfriend calls this insensitivity to pressure on my side. When I decided to take this project, and especially after the Nature paper, I decided to purify this factor, which takes 3 days of nonstop working to do assay for chromatography fractions. And it's not something that most of people do. It's doable, but just too much work. But I didn't care about it because I knew it's important work.
Right.
And I might have told you repeatedly, I don't think really a lot about my future, detail of my future. If something is interesting, I just do it.
Mm-hmm.
And my girlfriend mentioned me that she would not have done that, even tried that, knowing that how risky the project is. So that might have been part of it. So it can be either you're insensitive like me, or you can be brave, or you can be smart enough to know. Whatever it is, sometimes you have to take risks. And that's probably very important to do something new. You either need to be very confident or very insensitive.
Right.
I think.
And was that sort of insensitivity to pressure and to the future and making all of these things pay towards a nice career in science? where do you think that comes from? Is that just simply a part of your nature?
I think this came from my father,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Right.
He's like that.
Hmm.
Yeah, partly. This sort of, he's a little indifferent for things. He's very insensitive to a lot of things. Part of that reason, that big part of the reason why I didn't get along with my father when I was younger. And finding out the same character within me was this kind of interesting experience. But I'm pretty sure a big part of this is from coming from my father, because my mother is pretty careful and nervous person.
Right.
So I have to be thankful to my father.
Yeah.
And I think I have been on purpose trying to be insensitive,
yeah.
Because it's easy for me to live in that way.
Yeah.
So I try not to think about my future much, because it doesn't help usually.
Yeah.
But
the logic too is that if you just continue to do good work, follow your inspiration or whatever it might
right.
be, it's going to pay off.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Cross
the
fingers.
Thing is, the important thing is to do good work, and just worrying for the sake of worrying just doesn't do anything good. If that's the case, it's probably better not to think about it and just do what you want to do.
Right.
That's been my philosophy, and it's been good.
Right. Look, I only have about two more questions, and we probably should wrap up. How did you know when to end your postdoc? When the money ran out, or?
Oh no, Carl. So this was also a very strange situation, very untypical, probably. So I did interviews in the winter of, the beginning of 97, I think. Well, from end of 96 to the beginning of 97. And I immediately fell in love with Hutch. I knew I was going to come. I got an offer end of March, I think. And then this place is extremely flexible for everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's no teaching. So Mark Rudin, the division director, told me, okay, you can come tomorrow or you can come a year from now. It doesn't matter. Whenever you feel like, just come in. And Carl told me, and Carl had plenty of money. His lab is extremely well-funded. So he told me, you can leave soon or you can stay around, whatever you want. You're going to stay as long as you want. That's
right.
What he told me. Then, at the time, my girlfriend didn't have a job yet. So, she started looking for jobs. So I was going to wait until at least I know where she would be going. So, then she decided where to go. Probably summer. Then I decided to move. But at the end, basically, I was spending half of my time doing service for Carl's lab,
mm-hmm.
doing experiments for other postdocs, and spending half of my time doing East experiment, knowing that I would switch to East And Carr said, oh, do whatever you want. I mean, I know you're going to take that with you, but you can do your experiment. So he was extremely generous in that sense.
Right.
So I was sort of trying to return his favor by spending half of the time doing experiments for the lab. And I basically gave up all the fly projects, left everything with to the lab. So I didn't touch anything about the flies. As a result, it worked quite well. So he kept publishing good papers with my name on, even after I left, because mm-hmm. of that. So it worked out quite well for both of us. But I'm extremely grateful how supportive he has been.
Mm.
It's a little unbelievable. So so I think I decided to come here probably because I really wanted to start. But I could have stayed there longer if I wanted.
Right. When you were doing your graduate work, I asked about the culture of science and what you had learned. It was mostly what not to do, how not to set up the lab, perhaps, in some respects. I mean, you learned a lot, obviously. But in under Carl Wu, did you make any further progress again in learning how scientists keep their labs together, article writing, grant writing, recruiting
people?
Yeah,
so let's see. What was the most significant thing? He is a very good writer. I definitely learned a lot about writing. Of course, doing everything in English was a lot of a challenge. I remember first Nature paper I wrote something, and when it came back from him, I didn't even see the structure that I wrote. And for Cell papers, I could tell exactly what I wrote. The main structure remained. I was very proud of it.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty big. So that's something I must have learned. And grant writing, because people don't write grant. Then I didn't learn anything. I didn't even know how it looks. That's something I really needed to learn from scratch when I started my job here. Maybe I can talk about it on Monday. That was really funny. I was very, very naive. Again, Carl is a person who really loves science. And yeah, just like other two mentors I had earlier, it was pretty important for me to see how much Carl likes science. That was pretty big. And how fair he has been. And I learned how important it is to be fair to people. Let's see, I tried that hard. Of course, I cannot be perfect. But other than that, one thing I learned from Carl, I think, is to be optimistic. He's unbelievably optimistic. I think it's quite common among good scientists because we cannot avoid having ups and downs. And the first mentor of mine, Dr. Shinagawa, he was in very hard, tough conditions many times in the past. He was very optimistic. Dr. Niwa, my PhD advisor, was very smart, but not that optimistic, actually. Carr was probably the most optimistic, maybe partly because he was the most successful scientist, and it's probably easier to be optimistic. But he's very, very, very positive all the time. And I think I learned that from him, even though I think I'm a positive person. To start with, but it was great to see him being upbeat all the time.
Right.
Just by being upbeat and fair, I mean, you're almost half done to be a good mentor, I think.
Right.
So what that was big thing.
There's a saying, I think, well done is half done, or something along those lines.
And he doesn't complain much. That's another good thing. I seem to learn a lot about personal size from my mentors than practical scientific thing. But I've been very fortunate, I think, in terms mm-hmm. of mentors.
Okay. When we pick it up again on Monday, we'll go and we'll talk about the current research you're doing, mm-hmm. and then we'll move to more sort of public policy issues, mm-hmm. you know, patents and other theoretical sure. or philosophical issues. All right.